welcome to Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other business today. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Tuesday, February 1. You believe it, 2022. Happy National Freedom Day. How about that? Or if you prefer, happy Dark Chocolate Day. It's also the official Lunar New Year. So happy New Year again. Yes, every year around this time, more than 1.5 billion people stop to celebrate the start of the new year based on the lunar calendar. Lunar New Year 2022, the year of the tiger, begins today, February 1st. Celebrated widely across Asia and by people of Asian descent in other parts of the world, the holiday comes with many superstitions around wealth and luck. Here's one hint. Don't clean your home during the first few days of the Lunar New Year, lest you want to sweep all your good luck away. Eating sticky rice to bond families, or foods wrapped to look like gold seisi, like dumplings, for example, are said to bring good luck. Seisi, you might know, is a type of Chinese gold or silver ingot currency in the shape of an oval boat, used in China until the 20th century, when it was eventually taken over by the fiat yuan. So when in doubt, wish anyone you see the rest of today good fortune, or tell them, hope you get rich. Happy Lunar New Year. Let's get started with the market report. Now, gold was up most of today. It got as high as $1,809. It's down from that high, but still up about $4.40 at 1802 in the New York spot aftermarket. Silver up about 16 cents at 22.69. It was as high as $23 earlier. Platinum is up 7 at 1,035, and palladium's up 10 at $2,445. Let's see what's going on in other areas. Oil looks like it was up 21 cents. This is WTI crude, West Texas, at 88.36 in the commodities market. In the treasuries, let's see, driven by a dollar that closed down, U.S. dollar index down about 0.25 to close at 96.29. Still the 10-year yield up today. Looks like it was up about 0.014, close at 1.8, just shy of that. The 30-year staying above 2% at 2.119. That also was up. The 3 months was the only one that looked down today, and that's closing at 0.213. Percent. Now, in the ever-changing and, well, I got to say, surprising stock markets, we got the Dow Jones closing up 273 points at 35,405. NASDAQ up 106. Close at 14,346, and the S&P came back to close up at just about 31 points at 4,500 46 and change. Now, the cryptocurrency world, speaking of volatility, up, down, and all around, Bitcoin up today, 236 plus points, close at 38,696. That's on the that's Bitcoin itself, U.S. coin metrics. Ethereum also up close to 100 points at 2,782. And that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll call it a day for the market report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, also known as DGS Coins. Now in the news today, and there's lots of it as usual. Job openings totaled nearly 11 million in December, while the great resignation seemed to cool off. It's according to Labor Department data released today. Reflecting a tightening labor market, vacancies rose to 10.9 million. That's 600,000 above the estimate for 10.3, and an increase of about 1.5% over November. The rate of job openings as a share of the labor force was unchanged at 6.8%. Now, the so-called quits level, which had soared to record highs in recent months amid a bunch of factors, moved lower to 4.3 million. That's a decrease of 3.6%. The quit rates fell to 2.9%. So-called JOLTS report is considered a particularly important gauge when measuring labor market slack. Some are saying that December's numbers further pointed to how close the economy is to full employment. But that, my friends, is a whole lot of malarkey. There were 4.6 million more vacancies than workers considered unemployed for the month. January, however, is expected to be a trickier month for this job measure, as the Omicron variant has sent some millions more workers to the sidelines temporarily. Nick Bunker, who works for Indeed, their hiring lab, said today's report suggests that the latest wave of pandemic brought on by the Omicron variant didn't fully hit the labor market in December. In fact, he added, demand for workers as measured by job openings remained robust and layoffs hit a new all-time low. But while the data suggests no major impact in December, the outlook for January is less optimistic. Well, we'll know that in a couple of weeks, won't we? Federal Reserve policymakers said they feel the economy is close to fulfilling the Fed's dual mandate of maximum employment, which again is a joke. We'll talk more about that later. And has also exceeded its 2% inflation benchmark. Now, in other economic news, manufacturing growth lost a bit more steam in January amid a surge in COVID cases, while a measure of material costs again accelerated. The Institute for Supply Management's gauge of factory activity fell slightly to 57.6. It's the third straight monthly decline, and the lowest since November 2020, from 58.8 a month earlier. Still, readings above 50 do signal expansion, and the latest figures show that manufacturing does remain in gear, if only a low one. The ISM's measure of production and new orders both dropped to the lowest since mid-2020, suggesting the recent wave of infections due to the Omicron variant may have hampered plant operations, where people tend to work more closely together in confined spaces. Prices for materials used in the production process, already elevated amid lingering pandemic-related supply and demand imbalances, jumped nearly 8 points last month. That was the largest advance since the end of 2020. It was probably a reflection, at least in part, of higher crude oil prices. Timothy Fiore, who chairs the ISM's Manufacturing Business Survey Committee, says that the manufacturing sector remains in a demand-driven, supply chain-constrained environment. But he goes on to say that January was the third straight month with indications of improvements in labor resources and supplier delivery performance. Certainly mixed signals, to be sure. 14 manufacturing industry categories reported growth in January, led by apparel and furniture. Purchasing managers' data shows supply constraints continued to ease, though they do remain persistent. Supplier delivery times improved slightly, and the ISM gauge of order backlogs actually fell to the lowest since October 2020. The average lead time for materials used in production eased to 95 days in January. That's a slight improvement from readings in October and November, which, as you may recall, were the highest dating back to 1987. There's a bigger drop in the average lead time for supplies used for maintenance, repairs, and operations, down to 46 days, 3 months, after reaching a record of 49 days. At the same time, the average delivery time for capital equipment jumped to a record 167 days, almost 6 months. The ISM data also showed factories were having greater success beefing up payrolls. An index of employment there rose to a 10-month high. Down and all around, how about it? U.S. home building increased to a 9-month high in December, amid a surge in multifamily housing projects. But soaring prices for materials after the government nearly doubled tariffs on imported Canadian softwood lumber could hamper activity in the coming months. Today's report from the Commerce Department also showed the number of homes authorized for construction but not yet started surged to a record high last month. That's underscoring the challenges builders are facing right now from these supply constraints. And rising mortgage rates, although they're just bumping up a tenth here and a tenth there, could hurt home building further in the spring. Economist Jennifer Lee at BMO Capital Markets says that builders are gladly trying to meet demand, but supply problems and labor shortages are slowing them down. And she agrees that softwood lumber tariffs are going to hurt this spring. Now, housing starts rose 1.4% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.7 million units last month. That's the highest level since March. Housing starts were 1.6 million in 2021, up about 15.5% from the year before. Economists had forecast starts falling to a rate of 1.65 million units. Multifamily housing segment accounted for that rise last month. Starts for buildings with 5 units or more surged almost 14%, to a rate of about 524,000 units. Certainly a strong demand for rental housing. Single-family starts, which account for the largest share of the housing market, dropped a little over 2% to a rate of 1.2 million units last month. Now, the single-family home building soared in the Northeast and Midwest. Now, the more densely populated South, where the bulk of home building occurs, reported an 8.2% decrease in single-family starts. It also fell in the West. All told, the outlook for home building this year remains cloudy. Again, in November, the U.S. nearly doubled the tariffs on imported Canadian soft lumber to about 18%. See what happens in the coming months there. Now, we certainly know the pandemic has been far from easy for small business owners like Brianna Thompson. Her Brooklyn, New York-based boutique spin studio, it's a bicycle spin studio, had only been open for a few months before the pandemic hit. It wound up being shuttered for more than a year, reopening in May last year. And then, when you know, Omicron took hold of the city, forcing her to close her doors again in early December for a few weeks. Thompson says, I felt that shock of fear again, where we were like, what does this mean? It's going to be long term or just a short while? Well, fortunately, the studio reopened the beginning of this month. But the entire experience, which includes draining her savings and personal emergency fund of several months, has made Thompson more determined than ever to bring health and wellness to underserved communities, which happens to be her company's core mission. Yet, she knows that there may be more disruptions on the horizon. Fully 71% of small business owners say that the recent rise in COVID cases has negatively impacted their business revenue. That's according to a recent small business survey conducted by the too big to fail Goldman Sachs in mid-January. There are about 31.7 small businesses in the U.S. as of October. It's according to the SBA, the Government Small Business Administration. And that comprises 99.9% of all firms. 81% of small businesses have no paid employees, while 19% or 6 million firms do. Now, to be sure, generating enough revenue is the biggest post-pandemic challenge. I shouldn't say post-pandemic, but hopefully the late pandemic challenge facing owners. It's according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and MetLife. Inflation and complying with safety protocols are also among the top concerns. Yet, optimism remains. The Small Business Index notched its highest reading since the pandemic struck, with a score of 63, up from its record low of 39.5 in the second quarter of 2020. For many small business owners, rising inflation means either increasing prices or taking a hit on profits. 3 in 5 small business owners, in fact, say they've had to raise prices in the past year. Some have taken out loans or decreased staff to manage higher costs brought on by inflation without passing them on. Fully 69% of owners believe those issues have negatively impacted their bottom line. That's according to this bank index. Most also believe suppliers are favoring large businesses over small due to their larger volume of orders. That's a tough one, ladies and gentlemen. If you're small business owners, I hope you've been able to hang in there. Why don't we step back, take a break, listen to these few messages, and we will talk to you in a few minutes. I'm Dave Allen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, filling in for Melody today. We're on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, or call us again toll free at 1-800-375-4188. Or if you have something you want me to talk about, or if you have a question or a comment, feel free to email me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's Dave Allen, one word, A-L-L-E-N, .usa@yahoo.com. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is retirement. Economics professor Lawrence Kotlikoff says that for most Americans, retirement isn't just a decision to take the longest vacation of their lives. It's one of the biggest money mistakes that they'll regret. The reason is simple, he says. We are, as a group, lousy savers, and that's making early retirement unaffordable. Financially speaking, it's generally far safer and far smarter to retire later. According to Boston College research, half of today's working families risk a major living standard decline in retirement. The share would drop by roughly 50% if all workers were to retire just 2 years later. Of course, there are situations where retiring early is a great option. Some people have carefully planned and can afford to buy more leisure. Many have no choice. They run out of physical or psychological steam after 30, 40 years or more in the workforce, and others find their jobs have been automated or even outsourced. Still, almost two-thirds of people between ages 57 and 66 choose to retire early out of their own volition, despite having saved next to nothing. And most of them are able-bodied without disabilities that would prevent them from staying on the job. Now take the baby boomer generation, my generation, the 76 million strong of those born between 1946 and 1964, who are retiring in droves. Almost half of them have little or any savings. Let me say that again. Almost half have little or no savings. Indeed, their median wealth is just $144,000, less than 3 years of median household spending. If they had significant private, state, or local pensions to rely on, I mean, certainly things would look better. The thing is, though, they don't. Less than one in three have a pension apart from Social Security. As for those with pensions, many had state, local government jobs that weren't covered by Social Security. Worse, those receiving such pensions can lose most or all of the Social Security benefits accrued from working part career in covered employment due to Social Security's windfall elimination and government pension offset provisions. Now, the average Social Security benefit, which right now is $18,000 a year, could be far higher, but 94% of retirees take Social Security retirement benefits well before the benefit peaks at age 70. In fact, roughly 85% should be waiting until 70 to collect, according to Professor Kotlikoff. The age 70 retirement benefit is 76% higher, adjusted for inflation, than, for example, the age 62 benefit. Moreover, when Americans take their Social Security retirement benefits too early, they potentially condemn their spouses, or in some cases, ex-spouses, to far lower widower and divorced widower benefits. Failure most of us to save reflects a misfocus on life expectancy, which is routinely used to set one's planning horizon. Half of 50-year-olds will actually live beyond age 80. Quarter will make it to 90. That's according to current estimates. The answer is to delay your retirement as long as you can and to save as much as you can in the meantime. What's more, make sure you have an ample amount of physical gold and silver in your portfolio. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 for all your precious metal needs. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity, if not Brevity, is Golden. A lot of Fed talking heads out there yesterday and today. We already know that Fed officials are preparing to pull back their economic help as inflation remains stubbornly high and the labor market heals, however, haphazardly. The New York Times article today says that they're signaling clearly that the last business cycle is a poor template for what comes next. And I'll talk more about that in today's third segment, that during the economic expansion that stretched from the Great Recession to the start of the pandemic in early 2020, the Fed acted very gradually. It slowly dialed back bond buying meant to help the economy, then only ploddingly shrank its balance sheet of asset holdings. The Fed then increased borrowing costs sporadically between 2015 and the end of 2018, raising them at every other meeting at the fastest. But inflation was modest. The labor market was slowly crawling out of an abyss, and business conditions certainly needed somebody's help, so hey, why not the Fed? This time is different, though, more than one Fed president has emphasized that and did so yesterday, suggesting that their pullback in policy support is likely to be a lot quicker and more decisive this time around. Four of the Fed's 12 regional presidents spoke yesterday, and all suggested that the Fed could soon begin to cool off the economy. Policymaking Federal Open Market Committee is widely expected to make a series of interest rate increases starting in March, and the Fed could soon thereafter begin to fairly rapidly shrink their nearly $9 trillion balance sheet. The pace of policy retreat is still up for debate, and officials reiterated that it will hinge on incoming data. Several also noted that economic conditions are unusually strong. Atlanta Fed Pres Rafael Bostic said, the economy is far stronger than it has been during any of my time in this role, and certainly during any of the recoveries that we've been trying to navigate our policy through in recent memory. He added that any risk that our policies are going to lead to a contraction in the economy, i.e. a recession, I think they're relatively far off. While it did take the Fed a long time to begin shrinking its balance sheet last time, it was a lot smaller. But it'll probably move a lot faster in 2022, at least according to Esther George, president of the Kansas City Fed, who said, with inflation running at close to a 40-year high, considerable momentum in the demand growth and abundant signs and reports of labor market tightness, the current very accommodative stance of monetary policy is out of sync with the economic outlook. But I'll tell you, tricky questions lie ahead for these folks. It's about how big the balance sheet should be. And as I mentioned, the Fed's holdings have swollen to nearly $9 trillion, more than twice its size as when the pandemic began. George estimates that the Fed's big bond holdings were weighing down longer-term interest rates by roughly 1.5 percentage points, nearly cutting the interest rate on a 10-year government bond in half. While shrinking the balance sheet risks that are roiling the markets, she warned that if the Fed remains a big presence in the Treasury market, it could distort financial conditions and imperil the Fed's prized independence from elected government. As if the former phenomenon hasn't been happening for years. She suggested that shrinking the balance sheet could allow policymakers to raise rates by a smaller amount. Mary Daly, who leads the San Francisco Fed, also argued for an active but gradual path toward removing this policy underpinning. She argued the Fed is not behind the curve, but needs to react to the reality that the labor market appears at least temporarily short on workers and inflation is running hot longer than expected. Trying to combat some vicious wage price spiral, she insists. Still, she said she herself could support a rate increase as soon as March and hinted that 4 rate increases this year could be reasonable. Even so, she said it would be gross misinformation to suggest that officials are coalescing around a clear path forward. The Fed, she added, will have to figure out how rapidly rates increase as it learns more about the economy in the coming months. Whew. I'd love to be a fly in the wall with these next meetings. Now, trucking rates, in the U.S. anyway, are staying elevated, particularly in the blizzard-hit Northeast, as 2022 gets off to a rough start for anyone hoping to see supply strains fade along with the dreaded virus. Latest weekly figures from truckstop.com shows the average spot rates in the New England area hit a 4-month high, capping its first January increase in data going back to 2014. Truck freight costs eased in other parts of the country, but remained well above pre-pandemic levels, evidence that capacity shortfalls are slowing supply chains even after the holiday rush and may continue lingering for months to come. Logistics analyst Lee Klaskow says, we've been bullish on the truckload cycle for quite some time and haven't changed our tune. But added that rates will moderate into the summer, but should remain above pre-pandemic level, again, due to supply constraints. The roadway challenges are still rippling to other modes of transport. The South Carolina's Port of Charleston, for example, is a record number of import containers awaiting delivery. The stranded boxes have contributed to a line of 15 container ships anchored nearby, waiting to offload as of early today. In a statement late last week, the port said the bottleneck will take 6 weeks or more to clear. And on the West Coast, delays around the neighboring gateways of L.A. and Long Beach are longer than ever, and they've been long. Flexport CEO Ryan Peterson says he's worried about several longer-term factors that could actually add to this congestion. Contract talks this year with the West Coast Longshoremen's Union, plus new environmental rules that kick in 2023 that will force ships to slow down to reduce emissions, and companies over-ordering without a whole lot of visibility on their supply chains. Important issues, ladies and gentlemen. These uncertainties are weighing on companies as we enter into the second month of the new year. According to a Dallas Fed report released yesterday, almost 60% of manufacturers and half of retailers negatively affected by the recent COVID surge cited new or worsened supply disruptions. That sentiment echoed anonymous commentary in a recent Kansas City Fed analysis, which says in part, lead times have doubled in some cases, so if it is supposed to take 3 weeks, it's taking 6. Purchasing costs, supply chain, there's still massive issues. They basically started raising prices on select items to almost extreme levels to intentionally limit or even eliminate demand in some cases. And of course, another wild card is the political response. It is an election year after all. But at the Shipping World Council, which represents the container carriers, President and CEO John Butler is calling for a careful and targeted approach and more industry collaboration as lawmakers debate new legislation aimed at reforming ocean shipping. He said Congress needs to support the private sector in making each part of the supply chain more efficient and resilient with better data sharing and optimization and step up investment in U.S. logistics infrastructure. Working together, he added, ships and stores, trains and trucks, public and private sectors, we can manage the current import influx and position America's supply chain for long-term success. Well, we shall see, won't we? Now listen to this one, ladies and gentlemen. People are now getting paid to pick up their own pizzas. Worker shortages and increasing food prices are pressuring restaurants that deliver their own food to seek alternative routes to protect what little profits they have right now. With the social event of the year, Super Bowl 50, whatever it is, less than 2 weeks away, the pandemic near another peak and winter raging now in the Northeast, restaurants can't afford to miss out on a key opportunity to lure customers. Well, Domino's Pizza announced yesterday that it will offer customers a $3 credit through this spring if they choose online ordered carryout over delivery. The credit is good for a week and can be used for another carryout purchase. That's the catch. Delivery accounts for 2/3 of Domino's sales in the U.S. I'm actually surprised it's not higher than that. In any event, the move calls into question the company's long-running strategy of shunning third-party apps that specialize in delivery. You know, the DoorDashes, the Uber Eats, and Grubhubs of the world. But it turns out that Domino's has had a hard time getting enough drivers. So others, I mean, CFR food delivery analyst Angelino Zeno says it shows cracks in that business model. Now, unlike Domino's, competitors like Pizza Hut and Papa John's do business with third-party apps, which Domino's has bashed for what it calls surprise fees to its customers. But some believe Domino's current issues don't necessarily mean its long-term strategy is flawed. Some of the constraints you're seeing out there, Zeno says, like inflated ingredient cost and worker absenteeism, aren't necessarily going to be permanent. Well, let's hope not for sure. Analysts say to expect the food delivery apps to try to take advantage of Domino's moment of weakness on Super Bowl Sunday, February 13th. Well, you hear the music. That means it's time for another quick break. Stick around. We'll be back in a few minutes. Financial survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other business today. We're at 1-800-375-4188. Our latest American Survival newsletter has once again hit the streets. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletter and blog at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. Look for the mailbox. Click on that and give us your email address. You'll start getting the news right away. I have an article in this week's edition about the Nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities new study called The Chart Book, Tracking the Post-Great Recession Economy. Exciting stuff for policy wonks and listeners interested in finance and economics. This ongoing study is a comprehensive, insightful look at how our economy has fared since the financial crisis that began in late 2007. The chart book's blunt conclusions are actually an appropriate starting point for this article. It says this: the American economy was on solid footing in February 2020. It had been growing since mid-2009, and the huge job losses from the 2007-09 Great Recession had been erased by 2014. The economic expansion continued into 2020, becoming the longest expansion on record before ending abruptly in the COVID pandemic. Growth in the long expansion averaged 2.3% a year, below the rate the Congressional Budget Office was projecting just prior to the Great Recession. President Trump made bold claims for how his policies would raise the economy's sustainable growth rate significantly above the 2.2% growth rate it had achieved prior to his inauguration and produced a significant increase in the typical workers' earnings. Those claims, however, were much more optimistic than what the CBO and most other outside analysts expected and were not borne out. While the recovery from the Great Recession appeared to be faltering in 2015, it regained momentum in the second half of 2016, and economic growth trended upward with GDP 3.2% higher in the second quarter of 2018 than in the same quarter a year earlier. The growth rate trended down after that, however, and GDP grew just 2.3% between the fourth quarter of 2018 and 2019, which turned out to be the peak of the longest expansion in U.S. history. The 2020 recession turned out to be the deepest but shortest of all recessions in the post-World War II years. Substantial fiscal relief and recovery legislation, together with a highly accommodative monetary policy, allowed the economy to recover about half of the losses incurred in the recession relatively quickly. But the subsequent waves of the virus have contributed to an uneven pattern of GDP and employment growth in the post-2020 recession recovery and expansion, unquote. Now, post-recession expansion, as measured by the government anyway, was long, 128 months. Almost 11 years. Through February 2020, total private and governmental payroll employment had risen for 113 straight months, almost 9.5 years. Private employment had risen for 120 straight months, but total government employment was barely above what it was at the start of the expansion. Now, the study notes that the huge employment losses in March and April 2020, with total non-farm employment nosediving by a stunning 20.7 million jobs in April, largely erased the gains from a decade of job growth. And despite job gains in every month since then, including an increase of 1.1 million jobs in July last year, there were still 3.6 million fewer jobs on non-farm payrolls at the end of last year than there were at the start of the pandemic. Private employment rose by 211,000 jobs in December, but remained 2.6 million jobs below its February 2020 level. Federal government employment decreased by 2,000. State employment remained the same, with losses since February 2020 at 271,000. And local government employment declined by 10,000, putting losses since February 2020 at 673,000, hit very hard by the pandemic. Congress and the White House enacted relief measures at the end of December of that year, plus the American Rescue Plan in March of last year, which the study says helped to jumpstart job gains again from January through November anyway. The rise in payroll employment over its peak in the expansion preceding the Great Recession was almost entirely thanks to private sector job gains. Government employment was 459,000 jobs. That's 2.1% higher in February 2020 than in December 2007, accounting for only 3% of total job gains. In contrast, government employment in the three expansions preceding the Great Recession accounted for 13%, 10%, and 25% in each expansion's employment gains over the level of employment at the peak of the previous expansion. That's dating back now to 1982. The study points out that the Labor Department's broadest unemployment rate, which includes people classified as marginally attached to the labor force, recorded its highest reading on record in November 2009, going back to 1994. Now, listeners will recall that this U6 government rate includes those who want to work but haven't looked for a job recently enough to be classified as unemployed, plus people working part-time because they simply can't find full-time jobs. Well, the U6 rate fell steadily starting in 2011 and was below 8.8%, its rate at the start of the Great Recession, from February 2017 through 2020. And then it jumped from 8.8 in March 2020 to 23% roughly in April, but has since fallen back to 7.3% last December. But a far cry, I might add, from the 3.94% headline number that everyone from the Fed to your congressman to the main, you know, your corporate media are saying shows that we're close to full or maximum employment. It's hogwash. Even the 7.3% number is probably low. It's probably well into the double digits, almost twice that amount, if you believe the methodologies the government used back in the 80s and 90s. In any event, the study shows that the employment to population ratios of those ages 16 and older remained near its Great Recession low until 2014, when it began to rise as labor force participation leveled off while employment continued to fall. Nevertheless, in February 2020, it was still 2.6 percentage points below its rate at the start of the Great Recession. It fell in March and April 2020 to its lowest rate on record, 51%, although a rebound brought it back up to 57.4 in October, where it remained through December of that year. Now, further increases in 2021 brought it to 59.5% in December, which was still below the 61.2% rate at the start of the Great Recession. yet it remains below the peaks achieved in the 1990s expansion. Fell to a recent low of 69.6 in April 2020, has subsequently risen to 79% December 2021. Significantly here, marginally attached workers who are part of the U6 unemployment rate are not included in the labor force because even though they say they want a job, they haven't looked recently enough to be counted as unemployed. Go figure. If millions of Americans who expect to go back to work at some point are counted as not actively looking, well, then actual unemployment could be undercounted. And by a lot. The CBPP believes a jobs recovery going forward continues to depend on how well the virus can be controlled and the degree to which business investment and household spending respond to the rescue plan and subsequent recovery measures that might be enacted by Congress and the Fed. Importantly, the center says it will continue to track the evolution of the economy as the country continues to blaze a new trail on the paths to a new normal. Well, you can be sure that we'll continue to follow updates to this study and analyses by other think tanks and academics and everyday Americans as they come to our attention. I mean, with economic uncertainty and financial volatility growing toward modern day highs, you should expect nothing less. Now, finally today, Adam McKay's new movie, Don't Look Up, an entertaining and timely example of how our elected leaders react to crises. In the film, a comet's about to destroy all of civilization, but the country's leaders don't pay a whole lot of attention until it's too late and we're all doomed. Sound familiar? Well, to our next major debt crisis, welcome. In just a few years, over half of every dollar we pay in income taxes will go to pay the interest on our national debt owed by the public. And it's going to get worse. When that financial comet strikes, what will our politicians say or do? Will they even care, you ask? Well, let's take a look at how we got here. I mean, most informed Americans are aware that the national debt and interest rates are both rising. Americans will soon wake up to the fact that the interest on our national debt is costing taxpayers a frightening percentage of our national income and wealth. And the comet's about to hit. According to the Treasury Department, in fiscal year 2021, the amount of interest paid in the national debt was $562 billion and includes government transfers. The amount actually paid out to holders of these securities was $413 billion, debt held by the public. Well, that figure alone, which is over 20% of what we paid in income taxes in 2021, should be alarming when compared to other government expenditures. Compare the $413 billion we pay in interest to holders of the debt to the annual budgets of other parts of the government. The State Department annual budget's $35 billion. Justice Department, $39. Interest rate crisis is going to get worse soon, a lot worse, and here's why. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the average interest rate paid on the national debt in fiscal year 2021 was approximately 1.5%, historically a very low figure. Most experts agree that interest rate increases are coming. Well, that's an interesting random sound. Most experts agree that interest rate increases are coming, and a consensus expectation is that there are going to be 3 or 4 rate hikes by the Fed in 2022. Some say even 5. Well, last week, the Fed strongly hinted that its first rate hike since 2018 will take place in March, and the market is now pricing in again as many as 0.25% increases this year alone, making it a cumulative increase of about 1.25% by the end of this year. Well, as interest rates rise, which they have in dramatic fashion so far in January, so will the interest rate paid on newly issued treasury and other government securities. And while this is happening, our national debt is exploding before our very eyes. In 2017, the gross national debt was $20 trillion. Just 4 years later, that amount's approaching $30 trillion. The recent stimulus programs brought on by the pandemic helped add a staggering $6 trillion to the total. And the math is easy. Interest rates are still near an all-time low. According to the Treasury in 2001, the interest rate paid on the national debt was an average of 5.4%, about 3.5 times what it is now. If we get back to that rate at some point, which is not inconceivable, interest on the debt would cost American taxpayers $1.4 trillion based on our present level of national debt. That's twice the already bloated budget of the Defense Department. In fiscal year 2021, the total amount of personal income tax collected was $1.9 trillion. Future budget deficits already projected will add over $1 trillion more. Yes, the interest rate comet is now visible on the horizon. And most Americans won't stand for a scenario where most of the taxes we pay go to pay interest to holders of our national debt who live in Japan, China, the UK, and the wealthy here who happen to own a lot of treasuries. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to our loyal listeners for tuning into Financial Survival. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I got you.